Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island change nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated. And everybody got a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb, given to us, of course, by our fabulous Prime Minister John Key, former Federal Reserve banker, to help the economy. Today, my very special guest is... joining us for a good 2 hours. Well, frankly, because I listened to his about an hour of his interview with Heinrich Pongren on Red Ice Radio he did a while back, and I thought to myself, this guest I actually have to have on for some time, because I want to pick his brain, because this topic is something of particular interest to me, and yet I know remarkably little about it, provided the experiences I have. So his name is Alan Abadesa Green. He edited the book, the Sync book, explaining the science about meaningful coincidence, more or less. And what I've kind of started to realize about my life, at least, is that synchronicity sort of rules it. And the Sync book itself is a collection of 26 authors writing about synchronicity. And he's doing it as a editor and contributor. The incredible feedback and support generated by this venture led to the creation of the Sync Book Press, co-founded by Alan and the Sync Book team. And Volume 2 will be coming out on the 29th of next month, so watch out for that. He's also finishing the upcoming Suicide Kings, a book exploring synchronicity, archetypes, and esoteric symbolism in the JFK assassination, 9/11, and the death of Osama bin Laden. And he's also the author of the novel Look at All the Happy Creatures, which sounds really nice, doesn't it? And kind of fruity. And has written for a number of publications, having his self-published anthology on display at the Baltimore Museum of Art, and his animation has been projected on stage at the New York International Fringe Festival, commissioned by a Bollywood director, shown in corporate boardrooms, I'm sure it probably was shown there too, and featured in music videos. And many of his writings and whatnot are available at allthehappycreatures.com. That's allthehappycreatures.com. So without further ado, Alan, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for that. Wonderful to be here with you.
Yeah, you, man.
Yeah, you definitely threw me for a loop here. It was, but I'm happy to be with you for these 2 hours, and I like to roll with it. I think that's actually the secret of synchronicity: is something gets thrown your way and run with it, and let's do it. Let's make it happen.
Well, yeah, and which is the reason why I didn't have any reservations about at the very last minute asking you to come on for full 2 hours. It's like, oh, he's a synchronistic, he'll get it.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Well, what actually got you interested in all of this? Did you have some kind of like uber synchronistic sensations earlier on in life that just goes, you know what, I'm going to have to actually explore this topic a little bit more?
No, I mean, I've had really bizarre experiences throughout life, as I'm sure we all have. You know, just of course, things that looking back on it, you go, "Wow, that's really strange." And but actually, I got into synchronicity through conspiracy research because I was studying all these different. Basically, what are you doing with conspiracy research? Right, you're connecting dots, saying, "Hey, these two things seem to be connected." And I want to know why. And the conspiracy mindset is to say, well, obviously they're connected because they're part of some evil master plan, which in some cases is what's the reason that they're connected. But what happened is I started noticing things where it's like, no, these events are connected in ways that this isn't some orchestrated event. This is something else. This is an entirely other phenomenon here. And particularly when you see guys like Vigilant Citizen, you know, who does the breakdowns of the evil symbolic nature of everything, you know, which don't get me started. I mean, that guy is just looking for a buck. And that's the quickest way to do it is you say, hey, everything's evil. Let me show you something to be really afraid of and believe me. But of course, he starts demonizing everything. And I don't mean to just single him out. There's a slew of guys out there, you know, doing this. But when you start studying the symbolism behind it and then start putting your esoteric concepts of like, oh, well, this is really this Luciferian plot for blah, blah, blah. That's where I got into really gray areas. And I was just like, wait, hold on. I think people are jumping to a conclusion about a lot of these other connections when there's something else. And that's where synchronicity comes in, where you see that these archetypes emerge in time where the symbolism means something else entirely. And once you start paying attention to it, your whole world shifts. It just like, you know, when you get into conspiracy stuff, right? There's this idea of waking up. Oh, we want to wake up to the truth. Well, what you're doing is you're shifting your perception. You're saying, okay, so here's the reality as I thought it was. And suddenly I realized, no, everything's backwards. The government's all corrupt. The police are actually, you know, enslaving you, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You notice this whole other shift. Well, what synchronicity does is you start paying attention to it, and it just opens up this whole other window that, for me, I'm at a point where I just can't get behind a large swath of what gets labeled as conspiracy connections, what are actually synchronicity. And the way, you know, what reaffirms it for me is that every day some really bizarre thing happens that unexplainably personal connection that happens that no one could have known about, let alone orchestrated. So we have to assume the same thing happens on this grander scale, and that we can get into that later. But that's basically where I'm at.
Well, I presume you're well familiar with the idea of the fractal universe, yeah?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
All right, now getting into conspiracy, I've defined it as a simple word called scumbaggery, you know, of a scumbag, you know, the actions and portents of the such. And I came up with this concept of fractal scumbaggery. With any incident of, with any scumbag or incidents of scumbaggery that you look into, suddenly that starts to expand and includes other scumbags and even more scumbaggery in an infinite fashion. And the difficulty becomes, how many rabbit holes do you want to go down knowing that none of them actually end anywhere?
And it's the same is true on this consciousness level, you know, synchronicity and consciousness. People chase these rabbit holes. You have to know that there's no end to it. And to me, that is an answer in itself. A lot of people get lost in that, both on the conspiracy side and I think on this consciousness side. They get, you know, drawn into this sort of just new age endless loop of trying to hunt down, we're going to find the answer. Especially you're finding the meaning of life, or you're going to find out, you know, the Mr. Burns behind the curtain. Neither one of those is going to happen because, as you say, these are fractals. So, you know, there's a, you and I have darkness within us. We've all done scumbaggy things. We don't want to admit it, but we do it. On a daily basis, every now and then, we screw somebody that we don't mean to, or consciously, or whatever. And of course, we do this probably on a smaller level. I'm assuming that you are not as big a scumbag as, say, I don't know...
David Rockefeller. You
know, David Rockefeller. That's what I was going to go. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm assuming that's the case. And I feel pretty strongly that that's the case. But, again, so this is a... You know, to say, I'm going to find the ultimate source of this scumbaggery or evil, you know, it's then you turn into another George Bush. You're going to hunt out the evildoers. Well, who are the evildoers? And then again, if you come from this sort of get trapped in this new age cycle of I'm going to find the meaning of life if I could just chase down this pattern. To me, you have to stop there once you realize that. And that is the answer. The answer is that everything is connected. Everything is connected, and that everything seems to echo everything else. And that is a much bigger lesson than finding out, you know, who's pulling the strings at, you know, the WTO or something.
Well, I think what's kind of occurring to most people now is that they're kind of spending the vast majority of their life and their personal time researching into all of this conspiracy, exposing it, and yet getting very little reward from it. It's kind of like, here's your reward. You exposed David Rockefeller. David Rockefeller is now in jail. That's not happening. And so they keep researching in the hopes that someday they might actually get one of these people into jail. It's kind of like a communist who still wants communism, claiming that Stalin and every single other communist dictatorship who slaughtered all their people and brought up a police state was just doing it wrong. Whereas I'm inclined to think more along the lines of Einstein just saying, look, you're doing the same thing over and over again and getting the same result. It's insane. You've got to try something different.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's not to discourage people from trying to find out what's going on a geopolitical level. I mean, I really hope that I can stress that. That's not what I'm trying to do here. I'm just saying I think there is something bigger. And yeah, you know, just opening up a Facebook account and going, hey, look what this guy's doing, and, you know, essentially putting these things out there and trying to – I'm sure we've all had this experience. I remember when I was really more on the conspiracy side – trying to convince family members and friends, and you just get laughed at. You're just, you know, you're the crazy guy, you're whatever. So are we really making a difference by trying to beat people over the head with, you know, this truth? I have this truth. I know this horrible thing is happening. You don't want, you know, fluoride is killing you. I know you have to believe me, etc. Again, I'm not trying to discourage people from trying to get the information out there. I'm saying, as you say, the method in which we do it seems to be beating people over the head, which synchronicity operates on a much more subtle level. And so it's something that you just kind of have to pay attention to. And I find that by getting people to just pay attention, not going too far over their head, just kind of entice them, say, isn't that strange how such and such happened? Then you lead them on a road of discovery. And then, you know, whether they're going to find, you know, shadows behind the rock. You know, you pick up the rock, you're going to find David Rockefeller, and you're going to find, you know, Barack Obama and George Bush and all these different guys. Of course, that's there. So I think this is, you have to have this all-encompassing picture where you can see that that is true and that the, for lack of a better term, the light is also there. But more subtly, more something where we kind of show people these things exist, that this is how the universe operates, both on a physical control level and a, I'm hesitant to say, is this some sort of psycho-spiritual level? You know, is this God? Is this the universe? What is it? I hesitate to put a label on it.
Well, can you, and that's another thing, the whole point about labeling. Something David Icke told me is that if you can put a label on yourself, I'm a Catholic, I'm a Republican, I'm a Democrat, I'm a National Party aficionado, or I'm a CEO, or something like that. If you can define yourself with one single title, you're brainwashed, basically.
Sure, yeah, I think that's the case. Right, and isn't our idea to try and keep our minds open to all these different possibilities?
And this includes possibilities of who I really am, okay? Is it possible that I don't have myself totally figured out? Is it possible that there are things that I'm doing that I don't even know that I'm doing? Is it possible that thoughts that occur to me are not my own? You know, questioning yourself is a good thing, unless, of course, you turn it into one of those endless rabbit holes and you keep questioning yourself so much that you stop doing everything because you're too busy questioning to act.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you ever seen the movie? This is probably a horrible example because I don't know that anyone's seen this movie, but this is like, it's a terribly cheesy movie called The Lawnmower Man.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, there's this thing where the guy keeps kind of like diving into this information matrix, which for us is the internet now, which, of course, we can do this and we can find all this information. Perhaps on some sort of astral level, we can dive into this information matrix. And what happens is he keeps getting, he wants more and more and more, and he's learning so quickly. And then there comes this scene where it's like Pierce Brosnan says to him, you know, hold on, you haven't actually processed any of that. You haven't contemplated, what does this information mean? And the guy goes, I don't need to. I just want to know more. And I think this is a, you know, the trouble with, again, New Agers and conspiracy. So whether you're on the pronoia or paranoia, that's how we can kind of make this dichotomy. Everything's a conspiracy for you. The universe wants to provide for you, which I think is true in a lot of ways. Or there are some people out to get you, which is also true in a lot of ways. But when you just dive in to find out, I want to know more, I want to know more, I want to know more, if you don't stop and process, what is this information I'm taking in? What is this really telling me? And this is, again, why I said I found these connections, you know, people saying this is this occult ritual of 9/11, or there's this this music video is meant to brainwash you into some Luciferian plot or blah, blah, blah. You know, as an artist and as someone who works with a lot of artists, I know what my intentions were. And then I also know that if I was some guy who came upon my own work, I would go, oh, he's in on it. You know what I mean? Like I had written these stories that like really foreshadowed 9/11 before 9/11. And I know, you know, I have this drawing that my friend did. We were working on a comic together, which was done a year, literally 1 year before 9/11, which shows all of New York City destroyed. Is that predictive programming?
Is that
programming or?
Well, and this is the interesting thing as well. So many big foreshadowing events. You have so many people who call it before it happens. And some of them know why, because they've looked at the documents. Others don't know why. They're simply picking it up somehow, like a wireless. We'll be right back after the break.
On December 16th, 1961, the world turned upside down, then inside out, and I was born screaming in America. It was the tail end of the American dream. Just before we lost our innocence irrevocably, when the TV eye brought the horror of our lives into our homes for all to see. I was told when I grew up I could be anything I wanted. A fireman, a policeman, a doctor, even president it seemed. And for the first time in the history of mankind, something new called an astronaut. But like many kids growing up on a steady diet of Westerns, I always wanted to be the cowboy hero. That lone voice in the wilderness, fighting corruption and evil wherever I found it, and standing for freedom, truth, and justice. And in my heart of hearts, I still track the remnants of that dream wherever I go, in my never-ending ride into the setting sun.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And if you are incapable of catching it live, because some of you still have a slave job, you can go to the archives at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Up on the top left there, it says Radio Archives, a little drop down there, and you can pick your quality or anything like that. So all the information that you hear on this show, I would actually recommend in a lot of cases trying to listen to shows more than once, because often you will have really good info coming out in these shows that just kind of gets lost if you're only hearing it just the once. So repetition is the key to brainwashing, also incidentally to remembering stuff. So my very special guest, Alan Abadesa Green. Now it's Alan Abadesa Green. Could you explain the origins of your name there?
Sure. I mean, Abadesa is the last name I was born with. I don't know. I think it's Italian, or it might be Italian or Sicilian. I don't really know that side of my family very well. But that's the given name. My wife and I got married 2 years ago. I should probably know the exact number there, but it was 2 years ago. And it was the sort of idea. It's actually a very early phone conversation that we had was that we were just talking and talking. She says, oh, my favorite color is green. Or I was like, oh, my favorite color is green. And I said to her, well, I'll tell you what, if we ever get married, we can change our last name to Green. That was like one of our very early conversations, just a joke thrown out there. We ended up getting married a few years later, and she took me up on it. So in my personal life, I like to go as just Alan Green, but for purposes of, I worked for many years as Alan Abadesa doing things for purpose of public life, I'm Abadesa Green, and for personal, then I view myself as Alan Green. I feel like once I got married, instead of her taking my name or me taking her name or something like that, we just become something new. That's the alchemical marriage right there.
Well, Alan Abadesa is much easier to Google. When you search Alan Green, it actually comes up with a some kind of a NFL sports commentator, I think.
Probably. Yeah, exactly. That's why for purposes of public use, I stick with Abadesa. It's a much more easy to find name, sure.
Yeah. Okay, because it's a bit more unique than green because, hey, green's everywhere, isn't it? Now, speaking of green, I was thinking, I think it might have been yesterday, we had a guy called, what was his name, Dr. John Rush on the show, who talks about mushrooms and hallucinations and expansion of consciousness and all of that sort of thing. And I was wondering what part do those play in the whole idea of synchronicity? I mean, I've noticed a lot of marijuana users will have just incredible luck, out of sheer coincidence or this grand generous charity out of nowhere, and I've dubbed it potluck. I'm just wondering, do you see that happening around in any places?
Sure. So in the first sync book, there are two authors, one who's an ayahuasca shaman, and they see it as very literal, the plants communicate to you, right? This is plant consciousness, that they are living intelligent beings, that they can convey some sort of, they're sharing these ideas or these thoughts with you, this other perception, which I think is probably very likely. But there is also the more practical answer to that, which is altered states, marijuana, psychedelics. I don't like alcohol personally. I drank for many years. The first, in my 20s, like I was like 20 or 21, I smoked pot for the first time. I have had barely any alcohol since. It's like, why would I drink something that makes me sick and gives me a headache when I can have this wonderful other thing? But of course we know why alcohol is legal and pot is not. Regardless, I think that marijuana, psychedelics, all these things that can kind of shift your perception, they are useful as a tool for literally that, learning how to navigate a more fluid sense of reality, something that's not so cut and dry and jaded, 3D, materialistic, this is all there is. You smoke some weed, you take some psychedelics, everything gets really bizarre, and you have to learn how to deal with, wait a second, this is not normal. Again, just an altered state, and you learn to navigate that experience. To me, synchronicity shows us that the real world is highly psychedelic. You don't actually need to take anything. Like, I'm at a point where I don't really encourage people to go out and take psychedelics. maybe they, you know, every now and then to you know, jump back in and remind yourself or something, perhaps. But I think that the world is psychedelic enough. And that's what that many of the guys who I speak to on this subject, the other authors in my book and stuff like that, we all say synchronicity, what we're doing with synchronicity is teaching people how to have a psychedelic experience without the psychedelics. Very plain, that's what it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've had a look at a lot of people who do meditation and a lot of these other things to kind of get internal. And what I've noticed is that those people are trying to, they're trying to stabilize themselves by knowing more about their inner workings. And I've also found other people who don't do that in the disciplined fashion to spend time. And instead, they ingest substances and they kind of go shooting ahead intellectually, spiritually, of these other people who are sitting there and spending a lot of time disciplining themselves on how to figure themselves out. And those people, I feel, are sort of, I don't know, it's almost like they've lost touch with reality by being too internalized about it, as opposed to going into an altered state, realizing it's an altered state, and living your life anyway.
It's sort of like, I mean, everyone has their own thing. I went to this pool over the summer, and my wife likes to walk in at the shallow end and slowly get accustomed to the coldness of the water. I walk to the deep end, and I jump in. It's really cold and really shocking at first, and then within a minute, you're fine, and that's it. I like to jump in on the deep end. Some people like to walk in slowly. Hey, you know, if that's... I don't think anyone who's not ready for the psychedelic experience should just jump in at the deep end if that's really not for them. Because some people can, it can take them really off. You know, even for myself, I know the first time I took LSD, it's this wonderful experience in some ways, and it's like frightening, there's like frightening elements, and there's all these things that come with the psychedelic experience. And, but, you know, 24 hours pass, you know, you're basically sober again, you sleep it off and you whatever. But that's not, your experience is not over. It took me a year to put myself back together after that. You know, this is why we call it ego death. You are essentially, a part of you is dying, that sort of wall that you build around yourself, and this identity is gone. You go into the deep end, you expose yourself to all these other strangeness of the world, or all these, this complete altered state, and then you have to, again, process that. And to me, that's the longest thing. People like to talk about just take some psychedelics and, hey, you're going to jump ahead. Yeah, you're going to jump ahead, but you still need to process it. And I just kind of like to harp on that aspect of it because I know...
Well, it's sort of like jumping into a really, really fast car, putting your foot down. You've got to know how to steer that puppy properly at those speeds. Right. Otherwise, you might crash and roll and snap your neck like a twig.
Yeah. But if you get the you know, if you get accustomed to driving at high speeds, if you're a NASCAR driver or something like that, then to you, driving at 200 miles an hour is not really a thing. And that's why, whether it's meditation or psychedelics or whatever method you use to get into an altered state, it does have a very practical value in learning how to navigate what is a fundamentally psychedelic world.
So if the world is psychedelic, what does that mean for all the people that don't believe that it is and say that drugs are bad and opening their mind to other things is not a good idea? What happens to those people? Is this the mentality sort of the elite to a degree? Is that they see everybody else as negative, useless eaters, etc., who have no value because they're off trying to do all this airy-fairy stuff?
That's hard to say. I mean, I can't speak for the elite. As I was saying at the end of the last break, it's like I have things where it would have been accused of predictive programming. I don't know how much of my apartment you can see. I live a very meager existence. I'm not, you know, I'm no way a member of the elite. I had a friend, Steve Wilner, who's in the book. He, you know, he was accused of, he was talking about different ideas of consciousness. And people said, that's like Illuminati talk. You're working for the Illuminati. You're a shill for them. And he's like, oh yeah, the Illuminati came to me and said, well, tell you what, you can have no fame and no money, you know, and do all this for us. What do you think? And he said, sure, great deal. You know, we get a, I mean, just saying, there's that gets thrown around a lot. But I can't speak for the elite, but what I can say is that someone who is not prepared for a psychedelic experience, someone who's not prepared to realize that the world around them is intimately related to their mind inside, well, you're going to have a more negative experience. You're going to have a lot of shadow projection. You know, if you go, this is someone in a psychedelic state could have a sort of freak out because they're not prepared. There's a book, and I know this is sort of, I don't know if you know who Jan Ervin is. There's this whole Jan, new thing.
I had Jan on the show, I think like last week or the week before.
Okay.
Amazing guy.
So he's putting
in fact, he gave me your name, I think.
Oh, that's very interesting. That's very interesting. Okay. That throws me for a loop. Okay, so if that's the case, he's talked about this idea that a lot of these guys, like a Terrence McKenna, obviously Timothy Leary, there's a lot of conspiracy idea around Timothy Leary that he was connected through Harvard to the CIA, all these things. So, you know, people can discredit some of their statement or their agenda for that reason, but just shooting to the ideas, Timothy Leary, along with Ram Dass, Richard Alpert, they had this, and Ralph Metzner, they had this book called The Psychedelic Experience, which they based off the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is basically, this is an Eastern idea of you learn the art of dying. And what in a psychedelic experience is you're an ego death, right? Now, of course, we could go into the territory of someone could try and afterwards, when you put your ego back together, this is where brainwashing can come in. They can try and break you down and rebuild you in their image. This is could be a method of mind control for the elite. It's possible. I think that's very, very possible. But on a
But the other idea that I had, and I think where I was really going with this, is that the elite don't want us to know about this other world, about the psychedelic experience, because they know that it exists, and knowledge of the way the world really is gives you power and control, but only if other people don't know it. You can use it against them.
Right. So what I was trying to make the point though was that all right, if everyone is having a shared psychedelic experience, that means we could think of it as you're an aspect of my dream, I'm an aspect of your dream. Not pure solipsism like, oh, it's just me dreaming the whole world, but that this is a shared experience and we all kind of contribute in some level to consensus reality. Okay? So if you have a bunch of people who are frightened and who need this like security of the iron fist. You know, how many people, when I consider myself somewhat of an anarchist, and people say, oh, you want chaos. It's the idea of if there isn't the iron glove to control things, then everything falls apart. So there are people that are afraid that without the security of the ego, of the control system, that everything falls apart. So what I'm actually kind of getting at is, in a way, it's not so much necessarily that the elite want people to stay in this state, or maybe it's a feedback loop, but that the elite even kind of exist because we are afraid. Does that make sense? It's almost we're kind of dreaming them up because we need something. This was a Terrence McKenna thing where he said people like conspiracies because they like the idea that someone's in control. It actually makes them feel more secure. Even a conspiracy makes them feel more secure because it means that at least someone's in control. This world seems so crazy. At least someone has got their hands on the wheel. And when you find out, no, the world is so much weirder than that, that's frightening. So we're almost kind of dreaming up and wanting these elite to be there. Now, perhaps it could be a feedback that now that they're, you know, they depend on us as much as we depend on them in that system.
Well, I think the idea of the elite is to make people dependent, not independent. When you empower people with the ability to make their own decisions and control their own lives, you lose control over them. You can't tell them what to do because they make their decisions for themselves based on what evidence they have in front of them, which you can't control. All right, we'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen.
the show that's all about organized crime and illegal drug shipments being cashed in at the New York Stock Exchange. It's the Vinny Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And my very special guest is known by many aliases like Alan Abadesa, Alan Green, and Alan Abadesa Green. Welcome back.
Good to be back with you.
Yeah. Okay. Enough with the mafioso-ness.
No, it's good. I'm Italian, so it's actually really funny. I was during the break, I was thinking, he's recording this video. He probably sees how much I talk with my hands. So it was perfect segue to go right into the mafioso voice.
It is. And that reminds me, have you ever heard of a TV show called The King of Dirt? He's this Italian landscape artist who's got a TV show in New York kind of thing. And it was real funny. One episode, he had a laryngitis kind of thing, and he couldn't talk very much. It was real funny because he was Italian. He's not talking like this. And also he says, but it doesn't matter that much because I'm Italian, because I talk with my hands.
It's a form of sign language.
Yeah. Masonic sign language, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. But the other side of this is, you know, we all got to really just have fun doing this, because in the conspiracy realm, quite frankly, the jokes and the laughter of life seems to sort of take a wayside, because we want to look at the real importance of the information, and we want to make it very serious for people, and we want them to take it very seriously as much as we do. The difficulty being, I've found, is that if you're serious all the time, essentially, you are almost kneecapping somebody's capacity to deal with the information. If you cannot laugh at it, how can you truly process it and understand it to a degree?
Oh, yeah. And that's what I was saying earlier. Like, we try and beat people over the head with truth and go, like, listen to me, wake up. And, you know, this very, very harsh thing. And, of course, yes, it's a serious subject. But, yeah, I think if you can't laugh, I mean, what's the point of any of this? And then there's also like the comedian aspect, where they said, if you want to tell someone the truth, you better make them laugh. Because if you don't make them laugh, they're going to get angry at you for telling them the truth. So if you can at least make them laugh, then you can insert a lot of truth into your comedy routine.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what my producer told me, tells guests when he gets some for me, is that Vinny will make you laugh. And this show, I feel, is just sort of like my therapy, as much as for the rest of the truth movement kind of thing. Because, man, we've got so much harsh stuff to deal with, man, and it's nice to have sort of a holiday, a working holiday sort of thing, if you know what I mean.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. You know, and this is, you know, you made the joke earlier about my book, Look at All the Happy Creatures, sounds kind of fruity. Was the idea that's actually the darkest thing I've ever written. But the title is somewhat ironic, and it's the idea that, yeah, you need to insert some levity into the situation. Otherwise, there's, you know, again, like, my thing is also, we're not going to topple some geopolitical control system overnight, you know, especially in a 2-hour radio show. You know, not to discredit the work that anyone's doing. I just mean, obviously, we all do what we can, but this is piecemeal. Things take more time than we would sometimes like for the change to happen, at least on a physical level and on a level that we're talking about, that we have such a deep-rooted system of control. So in the meantime, you have to enjoy some of your life. Go out, have some fun with your friends, meet a pretty girl, you know, enjoy life, even for all the, trying to think of a nice word, for all the darkness out there, you still have to find a way to enjoy life. And, you know, this weird thing is that when I was writing Look at All the Happy Creatures, it was just pure, like, very Orwellian darkness. And it was in the process of writing that I was talking about that there is this extreme. The world seems to operate in this sense of extremes, that there's extreme dark and extreme light. There are things in this world that will bring you such joy and that are so beautiful and that are so pure that it seems to balance each other out. And this is, you know, we can get into a, you know, this kind of gets us into some metaphysical territory, but that seems to be how the universe operates. Yes, there's incredible darkness, but it actually kind of spurs on this incredible light that we try and bring to the situation. You know, then there's even, you know, as I say, because then you even have people who say, right, the whole idea of the Illuminati is to be illuminated or things like that. Some people think this is actually a conspiracy in itself to demonize anything that's light, that we, you know, to actually kind of keep us embedded in fear, is to say, fear light, let me tell you about these, you know, coffins in Alabama. Let me tell you about they're going to drop an atomic bomb at the Olympic ceremony. Oops, that didn't happen. Never mind, keep listening to my show anyway. Do you know what I mean? There's this idea of that in itself keeps you in this state of fear. So while I was writing the book, I mean, it was something I wanted to insert was to show that there is this also this very, very pure light. There's things like love, which, you know, people like to make that a new age thing. And hell, man, we don't have love and we don't have laughter. You know, that's not a world I want to live in. So these things very much resolve a lot of issues for us, and they actually keep us inspired to go on. So while doing this, this is where I kind of get into synchronicity, and this is why synchronicity seems to me to show this element of pronoia, this idea that there is something, this vast system around us, again, whether that's God, the universe, whatever term you want to put on it, there is this thing that seems to provide for us, that seems to communicate with us, that is way beyond any of these earthly things. And this stuff happens instantaneously. The very idea of synchronicity, it is a temporal phenomenon, right? Syn meaning to act together, chronos meaning time. So it's two events acting together in time. This is a temporal phenomenon. So it is very much instant karma, you know, a sort of John Lennon thing. It's very instantaneous. The fact that I could be thinking about something and then here comes a guy walking down the street with a t-shirt that says it, or any number of examples. This is instantaneous. Your world is reflected back to you every moment of every day. It is an instantaneous thing. And then we sometimes expect that changing the world on this geopolitical level should be just as instantaneous. We're coming up on December 2012. Everyone has this idea, oh, we're going to make some great, we're all going to become light beings and we're just going to, you know, suddenly all become Buddha. You know, to me, that's really far-fetched because you don't have 6 million people sitting on their couch watching, you know, sports and, you know, essentially couch potatoes that, oops, suddenly it's December 2012, I'm enlightened, I'm Buddha. No, it's a lot more work than that. So in making changes in the physical realm, you have to do some real work.
Well, I've also gotten this idea that basically there's the physical reality and the metaphysical reality, and neither of them exist in isolation. So if you want to become enlightened in a metaphysical fashion, you have to do something in the physical reality to let that in. You have to go and read a book or talk to somebody and that sort of thing. And this is what I dislike about some people in the New Age movement. I mean, I don't want to, you know, cast aspersions or anything like that, but I've spoken with so many of these people who really do believe that if they sit on their ass and do nothing for the majority of this year, that upon December 21st, 2012, they'll all of a sudden become astral traveling beings who can see auras of light coming out of other things, and that they'll become some sort of a new trans-dimensional species. And again, it's the abdication of personal responsibility. I'm going to sit on the couch eating corn chips and I'm not going to do anything about the fact that I'm fat, and by the end of the year, I'm even more fat.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I'm so with you. I mean, that to me seems like, and again, this is what I find myself trying to do. I don't mean to disparage New Age. I don't mean to use it as a slur or anything like that. I think there are some amazing ideas there. My point is that we need to find some kind of balance between these two extremes. And, you know, it's like you said, so you can have this idea, I'm going to change the world. This is a Buddhist idea. You change the world by changing your mind or changing yourself. That is, in a sense, true. But how does one do that? Well, by acting. You know, if I want to, I gave the example, If I want to move a chair, I could go to a monastery and study for 60 years to become this transcendental monk to learn how to move a chair with my mind. Or I can get up and move the chair. It'll take me 2 seconds. There is a value to the physical plane. So I actually think this idea that the people who just want to be light being astral travelers are missing the point on multiple levels. Because one, they haven't done the work. And number two, it's as if that the material world is somehow beneath them, evil. It's a lesser plane. No, nonsense. It's not lesser. It's of equal value. There's something, you know, very special about being able to have eye contact with a human being, human touch, whether that's, you know, romantic love, friendships, whatever. There is, of course, such immense value in a physical existence, and there is immense value in a spiritual higher consciousness experience. If you get stuck in just one or the other, if you're the ultra reductionist materialist who just ignores anything that's outside of the Discovery Channel, then you have a very limited existence. But if you just hope that you become a light being, you've forgotten about this whole other important realm.
Yeah, it's kind of like the arguments between left versus right. You know how that argument's been going on for like 100 years plus or something like that? And what I've noticed is that when people keep arguing and arguing and arguing and the argument doesn't go anywhere, what occurs to me is that they're both wrong. Otherwise, the argument would be over pretty freaking quickly, wouldn't it? So there's that element into it as well. So if you want to live your life via just the physical or just the metaphysical, essentially, you've automatically cast yourself to be wrong by sitting on one side of an incorrect fence. And the truth is always somewhere in the middle, resting in the gray area. Alan Abadesa Green is my guest, and we'll be right back taking callers 218-339-8525. Back in a minute. Number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're broadcasting live 5 days a week on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, bringing your daily dose of conspiracy and comedy to the floor, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. The caller lines are now open, 218-339-8525. That's 218-339-8525 if you'd like to ring in and ask us a question. My very special guest, Alan Abadesa / Green / just Alan Green, with the span. Hey, in fact, you've got the webcam on now. Could I get you to do this with your hand? Just open it up as wide as you can, just to the camera. Okay, that's the Alan Green span. The Alan Green hand span.
You want to see my wingspan here?
The Alan wingspan, yeah. With buffalo sauce.
You know, we ended that last segment with the idea that, you know, it's perhaps a combination of both being wrong or an all of the above. And I think this is where you get into this sort of quantum realm, just kind of going with that span idea, is that there's a full spectrum. And what happens if the guy on this end of the spectrum is right for him, and the guy on this end of the spectrum is right for him? You know, this is when truth gets kind of fuzzy. And I don't mean this, I don't know, you know, it's really hard, because I understand when people say it's this sort of Orwellian doublethink. I'm not trying to promote the idea that 2 + 2 = 5. I don't want to, you know, to screw with your head in that sense. But I do think it's important to understand that, and again, this is something that I found during psychedelics, my early adventures with psychedelics, was that, hey, wait a second, I suddenly realized that I thought you were being a jerk, but actually, I understand why you thought I was being a jerk, or I understand that, you know, that how, why you see it that way. And it kind of gets us to this area where we can at least understand each other better, and that we understand the world seems to operate on this weird full spectrum. It operates on that, not my span, but, you know, some sort of weird spectrum of 6 billion people all being partially right, partially wrong, and, you know, that's right for them. It's what Robert Anton Wilson called reality tunnels. You know, the idea that it's right for you because that's your tunnel. This is how you see things. If I see something very differently, am I right, wrong, or is it just a difference of perspective? So this is why perspective shifts, learning to navigate shifting perspectives, is so important.
Okay. Now, getting off that topic a little bit, we were talking about the responsibilities of generations in the chat room there, and what's occurred to me personally is that both elder and younger generations are actually involved in this movement to overthrow the elite and to restore some kind of morality, some form of reality-based life, essentially. Because at the moment, it's all very much the opposite of that. There's very little reality that's reinforced in our daily life other than false paradigms, false realities, essentially, through the media and the education system and all these other things that, basically stop us from thinking. And that can be as simple as dehydration. Most people are walking around dehydrated. There's some people who go into do fastings and things like that, and they're only 50% water. Where they should be like 70-80%. And when you're dehydrated, you can't think properly. So what I was thinking here is that the youth of today, okay, the Generation Y, Generation X, Generation Z, or Z, or whatever, okay, it's their responsibility because they've got the energy and they've been brought up in this system, so they've got the technical know-how with the web design and all of that kind of stuff in order to make a digital resistance using the weapons of this time available to us, right? They're capable of doing that because they're young, they've got the energy, they've got the creativity. And any major corporation knows that if you have really, really high-flying young people, you milk their ideas from the ages of 20 to 30. That's actually when their creativity and their best ideas will come about. When you get older, on the other hand, what you've got in retrospect is a lot of experience, a lot of wisdom, but you don't have quite so much energy or creativity to fulfill or use them to a degree. So I was thinking this, elder generations, younger generations need to be brought back together, because at the moment, all I see in the media is a whole bunch of people saying, oh, these young people, they're into their iPods and they're this, that, and the other, you know, and it essentially it casts a web of this is your fault. The reason our society is so franked up is because of your fault, your generation, that kind of thing. When the reality is, it's actually the elder generation who allowed this new world order to be set up over the past 30 to 40 years that they've been adults that are more directly to blame. However, the problem being is that you have to live through 30 years of the system before you suddenly wake up and realize, oh my God, things aren't what they seem. And by then, it's too late.
Yeah. You know, it's funny.
Hold on. I just want to finish this point. So, point being, the youth have got the energy and the creativity, and the elders have got the experience and the wisdom. You put them together, they're unstoppable. And so naturally, everybody's been dispersed on those grounds.
Yeah. You know, just quickly to your point about that the older generation was the one who allowed this to step in. I mean, we could argue that it's been going on much longer than them, but I took some resentment a few years ago. There was this thing, it was here in the United States. They were promoting the idea that it was like the greatest generation. And they did this series of like documentaries and books about the guys who fought World War II. And it's like, and I'm thinking, okay, that's great. You know, they went and fought Nazis in Europe. And then they came home and there was Nazis running their country. Why didn't they say, hey, you can't, you know, if I'm going to fight you there, I'm going to fight you here. It doesn't mean you have to have some sort of military coup. I just mean on a very practical level of, hey, wait a second, we're not going to allow this to happen here. I think that's, you know, sometimes I wonder if it's, you see pointing the young people have the ignorance that we don't realize how messed up it is. And there's also just the, you know, being naive of like, I don't know if you've ever read Sinclair Lewis, It Can't Happen Here. Is this idea that, oh, you know, he wrote this while fascism is taking over Europe. And he's saying, no, this is happening here. And everyone's going, no, that's their problem. Like, in America, we're cool, we're free. When, of course, you realize that we're not. And even that, I think, is almost naive in the sense of he's worried it's going to happen here. What happens when we realize, no, it already happened here? It's like the, you know, we expect everything to be like this movie plot where, okay, we've figured out the bad guy's master plan. And, of course, he's telling us about it through his predictive program. And he's going to reveal his master plan. And now we get to stop him at the last minute. What happens in the true... I don't know if you've seen like Watchmen or actually read the graphic novel is much better, but where it's sort of like, oh, no, I'm not a third rate villain that I'm going to tell you my plan so you can stop it. I already did it. I did it 2 hours ago. Or in our case, it already happened here 100 years ago. We've been living in a corrupt system, perhaps longer than just New World Order. It seems that since, you know, that first monkey with the stick learned to, you know, beat someone over the head, there was an alpha dog. There was someone who said, all right, I'm going to run the show. The first time someone said, figured out how to plot against someone through religion or some sort of tricksterism, scumbaggery, manipulation, it's been going on. So that's why I think there is something that's we have to address more fundamentally. On a personal level, on a global level, all these sorts of things. But yeah, I like your idea. Bring the ages together and bring the countries together. You know, people freak out with this idea of a one world. You know, we really do need that. We don't need a one world government. We don't need a one world control system. But we do need to realize that, hey, you're in New Zealand and you're facing the same problems that I am here in New York. What if we work together? You know, there is a one, we all share this planet, we all share the same problems, and we can share solutions and ideas and help each other network. So I don't think in that respect, the idea of this global mindset isn't a bad thing, just as long as it's not obviously with a one world government or one world, new world order control system, sure.
Well, and the concept behind that is removing authoritarianism and taking it back to smaller and smaller and smaller until eventually, hopefully, there will be no rulers. There will only be collaborations between people in the future that are open and transparent. I remember asking Bob Chapman one time, the late Bob Chapman, is it possible to eliminate corruption once and for all? Okay, could you put a methodology in place to ensure that those who have a corrupt or alpha dog mindset, maybe that's not the correct entire term that I'm trying to put across here, psychopathy more or less, is it possible to put systems in place to prevent those people from ever gaining power again? And he said unequivocally no, because corruption is a perennial problem. It's always there. And I think that's part of the human nature and our capacity to think and make choices that makes us so susceptible, I think, to greed, lust, pleasures of the flesh, and what have you, that drives people towards it. You have a look at any cult leader. He's usually only after three things, usually all three: power, sex, money. right? And then that's all you really that's all the base cravings of the reptilian fight or flight part of our brain are. You know, I want these resources. I want that woman. I want this power. I want to be able to kill that person without having anybody be able to pull me up on it. That kind of thing. And my kind of idea is that the only way that you can really have power over other people is if other people give you their power and expect you to be responsible for it. Whereas if people were responsible for themselves, they would give power to nobody and nobody would ever have power over them.
Absolutely. Not to be a contrarian, because I agree wholeheartedly. There's like a few different ways I want to run with that. But just to say, I don't think that lust, power, and money are inherently bad things in the sense that, again, this is personal responsibility, is that we should have personal power. I think sometimes these things get, I refer to it as being bastardized, then demonized. So there's nothing wrong with personal power. There's nothing wrong with a healthy sexual appetite. There's nothing wrong with getting paid for your services. You know, unfortunately, a lot of people in this alternative research community, I can't speak for what your situation is, but we put a lot of time and work into this, and there isn't really much that's coming in. You know, we're not an Alex Jones where we have, you know, mansions or something like that. We're not, you know, it seems the only way you get to that power is to be a complete shill. I don't want to be that, but I would like it if people, the people who enjoy my work, somehow compensate me for my time. I don't think we should be afraid of that. And it doesn't have to be, you know, I don't want Federal Reserve notes, but some sort of support for each other is not a bad thing. The idea of having personal power, I wish more people had personal power, then they would take more responsibility. And the idea that we have this other thing which completely demonizes sexuality, I don't think is healthy either, because it actually helps to fracture us. You see right now every TV commercial, every movie is playing on your sexual desires, but we're still in this very, like, almost like Catholic schoolboy mindset of, oh, it's dirty, oh, it's bad. And the New Age movement does it, any religious movement does it. We know there's a very strong Christian influence in the conspiracy crowd. So it's always going to be something that's kind of demonized as sexuality, when I don't think that's inherently bad. I think this is a very natural drive, and I think it just needs to be something that's brought back to a more pure sense. You don't want power to lord over other people, but you should have personal power so you can have that responsibility. You shouldn't want lust that you just want everything and that kind of consuming or abusing, this almost pornographic humiliation sense. That's terrible. But to love someone and have a healthy sexual appetite with them, hey, that's part of life. That's one of the great pleasures of life. We should enjoy that as part of the one of the nice things about a material existence. So all these things, I just don't think, they're inherently bad. We've just have really distorted visions of what that means. Does that make sense?
It's about restriction of power and not having other people tell you how to restrict it, hence you're responsible for it. Okay, so let's say, I remember my brother when he taught me how to drive, he drove us out to Pihar Beach, you know, just kind of like a gravel road down, you know, lines of trees and ending at a farm gate. Okay, there's no traffic that's going to be coming down there, just so he could teach me how to drive. And first thing he told me was, just remember, I'm your passenger in your car. You are responsible for my life. You are responsible for the life of every single other motorist on the road. If you crash into them, it's your fault. If you do anything wrong, it's your fault. And the worst thing would not be if you died in a car crash or something of that nature, but it would be if you survived in the car crash and you turned four young students or something like that into wheelchair-bound vegetables for the rest of their existence, and you have to deal with that guilt because you didn't take responsibility, you know. That's what he told me before even turning on the key to the car. And that stuck with me in more ways than one. So the key is just knowing how you affect other people and having empathy ahead of time helps you to restrict your power and use it responsibly. But sadly, that kind of lesson is no longer taught wholesale. And instead, we simply appeal to authority and expect them to solve our problems and give us rules to follow so that we don't have to do any thinking for ourselves. We'll be right back after the break.
To fly to New Zealand by plane from New York City, it takes 22 hours. So from the Twin Cities, 19. I mean, I fly all the time, and 6 hours on a plane is like a lot, and 19 is wrong. And they distract you. They feed you, and then they feed you some more, and then they feed you. Give me a dessert. Give me a dessert. Give me a dessert. Have your dessert, you prick. Give me that dessert. Have a Bloody Mary. Yeah, give me a whiskey sour. Yeah, give me whatever you got. Just more liquor, more liquor, more liquor. And then when you're done, there's still 16 hours to go. If you want to know what it's like, you can experience going to New Zealand. It's very simple. Sit in a chair for 19 hours and take your hands and press your head as hard as you can. And don't stop. Don't stop. 19 hours, just like this. And then at the end of 19 hours, you pull your hands off and you feel like you're in New Zealand. You certainly won't feel like you're home. They say that New Zealand's beautiful, and I don't know, because by the time I got over the jet lag, I had to go. And it seems to me, if you're going to travel for 19 hours to another country, when you get there, they should have the common courtesy to speak another language. I did not fly all this way to hear English again.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on American Freedom Radio, where you're, I think we're almost 19 hours ahead of you on the time frame, or 14 hours, something like that. So we always broadcast live from the future. So send your lottery numbers in to producer@thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. We'll tell you whether or not you won. My very special guest, Alan Abadesa, aka Alan Green, Span. As my very special guest today. And what we were talking about over the break, you were starting to tell me a story about how you kind of heard about my show and stuff like that. Could you kind of recap it?
Oh, someone contacted me, a guy who's been incredibly supportive of my work. His name is Guillaume, a gentleman from France. And he contacted me and said, have you heard of the Vinnie Eastwood Show? And I had definitely heard the name, and so he sent me the link to your website. And then I realized, oh, American Freedom Radio, I see you've had Frater X on your show a number of times. I've done his show a number of times. He's actually going to be in the second volume of the Sync book, which comes out next month. He's one of the contributing authors. So I know him very well. I speak to him fairly regularly. And I was like, okay, a friend, you know, I was like, if Guillaume says you're good and Frater X says you're good, that's the sort of thing where it's like, okay, now we have an understanding. That's what we were kind of getting on, was that you can get a sense for somebody partially by the company they keep and partially by you see that they're actually out there trying to do something, that they're trying to be active and spread information and really doing their best. And you can get a very quick sense, is this someone that's kind of, you know, not, I don't mean necessarily a government shill, but a shill for... you know, just advertise, you know, someone who's like a real, I'm trying to think when I have a hard time coming up with really nice words to use on your radio show for American Freedom Radio. I feel like, I don't really have the American freedom of use in my, colorful language, but,
well, that would depend on whether or not there's such a thing left as American freedom or ideals.
Exactly. But hard to say.
But we know what you mean.
But no, so I dove into some of your stuff and I was really enjoying it. And then I was, but like I said, it was just something that clicked very easily for me. It was okay. You get this sense of you were saying you get the sense of what people do based on, you can Google their names and you can get a sense of the kind of work they do. But then there's also something of seeing who they're actually interacting with on a regular basis. And it just kind of really clicked for me very easily.
And what started off this conversation is I was talking about volunteerism, and when you're in these positions, when you're in the public realm and you're making media content, more people will see what you're doing, essentially, and as a direct result, you have an audience that will, in many cases, send you emails thanking you for the work that you do. Or giving you phone calls asking, is there any way they can help and what have you. And I've been doing this for a number of years, and my interpretation is that the vast majority of people who offer to help won't. The vast majority of people who will help don't ask if you need any help. They just go ahead and help you.
Yeah. Oh, okay? Yeah.
So you need to spend. You don't need to spend a terribly large amount of time sifting through who's going to help you and who won't, because at the end of the day, they'll make the effort if they are going to. And if you're in the position where you need help and what have you, asking us to help you help us actually just creates more work for us. You know what I'm saying? I want to help you by creating more work for you.
Yeah, that's definitely true. It actually makes my wife crazy, because like I'll be cooking in the kitchen and she'll come in and she'll say, "What can I do to help?" And I'm like, nothing. Like, you know, because then you have to sit there and like, well, how do I figure out how to, and you know, not be rude. And she was like, "Why are you being like that?" It's like, because then I have to stop thinking about what I'm doing and then now find a way and devote time to giving you this task where I could just do that in that same amount of time. It doesn't mean that the help wouldn't be appreciated. And like I said, especially when it comes to stuff on the internet, I mean, you're always trying to do something to promote your material, not necessarily just because you're a whore, but because, you know, that's how you do it. I mean, you know, you feel you have something important to say, you're trying to get it out there. I think that's what 90% of us are doing, not because we're looking for millions of dollars, but because, hey, I want to get my stuff out there. So it's always helpful when someone, like you said, someone can put a banner on their website, someone offers to just, you know, put it on their Facebook page, or someone gives you a nice review on a website, gives you a nice review on, you know, we have books on Amazon. You know, someone wrote to me personally and said, "Hey, I really loved the Sync book." And I said, "Great, would you be willing to write a review on Amazon?" So, you know, the guy did. And I've had other people say to me, write to me, "I loved your book." And I said, "Great, would you be willing to write a review on Amazon?" Crickets. All right, well then you bothered to write to me, and I very much appreciate that. You know, that kind of helps motivate me to know that people care. But then, all right, then pitch in, you know, help get it out there.
Well, if you really believe in something, you'll make an effort to promote it, won't you? And we got onto this concept of money in the truth movement, and I'm of the opinion that the conspiracy theorist is now a growing market, essentially. And by conspiracy theorist, I mean a person who believes that powerful people who have a lot of influence use their power to maintain their influence, right? So that growing number of people, in general, like I've looked at the analytics for the people who listen to my site at least, and a good 50% plus within the 40 to 60 age group, right? It's actually the my parents' generation that are listening to me, that are listening to this type of information. And also I've found I've appealed a lot to a female audience as well, about 35% of the visitors to the website, about 35 to 40 are female, which apparently is very difficult to get the female audience listening to this type of content. And I'm not entirely sure where I'm going with this, but what it says to me is that this information is being put out in many, many different formats. There's donations, there's subscriptions, there's products for sale, there's advertisements, there's banners, there's collaborations with other websites, there's separate websites, there's Facebook, there's Twitter. It's going out in many, many different directions. And what I've found is that you really, in order to appeal to a wider audience, essentially you just need to be really open and listen to them, kind of thing. And if they suggest a guest, as this person did with you, I don't know, maybe it grows the audience by knowing that they can participate in some way. And that's actually what I want people to do, is I want them to participate. I want them to collaborate. And you can do this very easily because there's a lot of things that I need done. And I've even created pages on the website that go through in detail all these little things that I need to save me time explaining, right? But, of course, the fact of the matter is few people will take up that opportunity because few people are tuning in for anything other than the entertainment value sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really hard. I mean, as someone who does it, because I don't know if you have what kind of team you have or if it's you, but I know for me, I mean, I have to be the web. Yeah, exactly. It's me. I'm here. You know, people go like, oh, well, it's like, no, that's me. That's me. It's like, I'm the one who does the web, you know, like I have to do all the web coding. I have to do sometimes the graphic design. I have to do, you know, for these books, I have to do the pre-press. I have to do the editing. I have a small handful of people who do help me out on certain tasks, and I should give huge, huge credit to them. I have Justin Morgan, who has designed book covers for the Sync Book Press books. They're beautiful. Jason Barrera, who helped me edit three of the books. You know, just these things where people chip in to give some of their time is a huge help. But on the majority of the scale, I mean, we do a radio show once a week, and, you know, I'm doing the editing, I'm doing the uploading, I'm writing, you know, the show descriptions. This is so much time goes into this, and I don't even know, sometimes I don't even know where to start to ask for help, but it's something where I don't know if people come across something and they realize that's all someone's labor, you know? That's why I was kind of making the point that it's, you know, we shouldn't be at a point where we're ashamed of trying to make something. You know, if someone puts in an 80-hour work week at a job, at a, you know, a standard job, they get paid for it. And if people enjoy the services they provide. Again, my apartment, you can probably see about a quarter of it. It's literally that small. You can't see much right now. My apartment is tiny, okay? This isn't an appeal for money. I'm just saying is that no one is making a luxurious lifestyle off this. And I think the people who aren't out there shilling and the people who are trying very sincerely to do this sort of stuff, I don't think we should be ashamed to hope that someone is trying to provide for us in some way to compensate us for our time. I really don't think that's something we should be ashamed of.
This is true. And if you don't ask, you don't get. That's what I've found. There's a lot of struggling radio show hosts out there, but they're too proud to ask for the help that they need. I don't ask for much very often, but when I do ask for something, it's usually because I'm in an emergency. I can't see a way out of it. But I've had to move house twice in the last year, kind of thing. You know when you move apartments or something like that, you've got to pay your rent up front, your bond up front, yeah. and all of this letting fees, blah blah blah. It's incredibly expensive, and I just didn't have anything, you know. So I'm just like, I have to move out of here, and I can't. So I ask my listeners for help, and usually within a short time frame, and half the time that I need it, enough has come in to cover all those things. So in essence, it's like my listeners are my guardian angel in many ways.
Oh yeah. That's beautiful. I think that's something that we all need to be doing. And this is the kind of global support network, instead of a global control network, a global support network where we're, you know, providing services for each other, taking care of each other when we need it. This is something that's, you know, I'm not promoting some, you know, communist utopia. I'm just saying, hey, you enjoy something, we should be supporting each other. And I think when people do that, and I do see people doing that, and I think that's wonderful. Now we have things like Kickstarter, where people are pitching in to help promote projects they really want to see. This is a trend I really, really like, and I just hope to see more of this.
It's really exciting. And it all comes down to the one person doing it, though, at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Okay, so you'll usually have this one person who's really, really brilliant. okay, and they've got all these ideas, all these talents, all these skills, all these abilities, and they'll keep using those talents, skills, and abilities, and they'll keep growing, but they find it difficult to get to the next stage because there's something missing. And often they just need to ask, I need this little thing that's missing right here. Can somebody help me with that? And invariably, if you're involved enough with your audience, like I try to reply to every email, every Skype message, everything, to try and keep in touch and be accessible to people for this very reason. Anybody who I'm talking to could be the very person who I've needed all along.
That's in a sense, that's synchronicity also, because we don't realize who we're interacting with, both as the listener, because I listen to plenty of shows that I enjoy, so both as listener as someone who's creating content, we don't always realize who we're interacting with and the relationships that are forming. And this is synchronicity, because someone found my website through whatever method they found it. You know, so they were interested in something, they heard of somebody, okay, now we check out Alan. And then he's like, oh, I also like Vinnie Eastwood. And now put the two of them together. And this is a process where we're making connections that are so valuable that we don't even realize the value of them at first. And just to kind of bring it a little bit back to synchronicity is to say that this ultimately is how the universe works, is that things are connected in ways that very often we're just not paying attention to, or we're not really giving it credit for, and that you realize somebody who you sort of is on the sidelines of your life actually comes in, brings exactly what you need at that moment. And sometimes you have to have an active participation. And sometimes it just happens there.
Well, see, on that as well, it's an interesting aspect, is that you need those people to come up to you to solve those little problems, but also you have to realize the inherent responsibility that there's a lot of other people out there for which you can solve their problems, okay?
Exactly.
And the thing is, you can't just be like, I want you to pay me for this, I want you to do this. Do it out of love and gifting and trying to help somebody, and then it comes back. We'll be right back. Final segment here. All right. 2 hours seems like a long time, but it disappears. It's like mist in the morning. kind of like the facts that politicians use to justify their agendas. And speaking of facts and agendas, if your agenda is to tell the truth and this becomes your job, this becomes your income and revenue source, unlike most jobs, you don't have set hours. Unlike most jobs, you don't have a set salary or wages. You don't have a boss. Also, it means you don't have set holidays. Okay, so normally when you're working 5 days a week, you'll at least have the weekends to recharge. Doing this kind of work, having the weekends to recharge is a rarity. Okay, like I had to do two radio shows this weekend, and I've got lots of archiving and stuff like that I'm backed up on. So just understand and appreciate the situation all of us in the truth movement are in, is that although when you take personal responsibility, you get all this freedom, but at the same time, you lose a lot of those freedoms that normal people who are working a slave job take for granted. And the grass really is greener on the other side always. So, you know, and that's why most people cannot do this. Okay, it really is too much for a lot of people. They don't have whatever it is that makes us capable of doing this. Some people just aren't ready yet. I'm not sure if they'll ever be ready, frankly. But I want to help and try and make sure that they can be in some way, shape, or form. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, God, yeah. I think, what is it, Spider-Man says it best, right? With great power comes great responsibility. but damn, is it true? There are nights here, like in this last week, I've barely slept. We're putting the book out. The Sync Book Volume 2 comes out next month. I'm still putting finishing touches on it. You know, it comes to 7 a.m. and my wife's like, aren't you going to bed yet? And I'm like, no, I have to make another cup of coffee. I still got work to do. You know, this is basically every day is sleep when you can, just keep working. I mean, it puts a strain on personal relationships. It puts a strain on your finances. It puts a strain on all these things. But if your heart's really in it, like I'm at a point where I don't know what else I could do. This is like, this is me. So how do I don't know how to walk away from this as much as it's a struggle sometimes. And it's a tremendous time commitment. It's a tremendous commitment all over. I don't know how to walk away from this because this is me. This is my passion. And I just feel like I have to give 100% to this. So if someone else out there feels the same thing, just know going into it, yeah, this is more than a full-time job. This is a life-consuming quest to find the truth and to find a way to put it out there and spread it and all these things.
I remember that, I think it was during 2000 election of George Bush, I think, and this lady comes up on stage and she says, you know, Mr. Bush, I have to work three jobs to support my family and I'm still broke. And he says, oh, yeah, well, that's uniquely American, isn't it? and, you know, the reality of it is nobody should ever have to work that hard just to survive. But the other reality of it is that you actually do in this system because it has been built in such a way where to simply survive is incredibly hard work. And I share that that situation that you're in as an I can't walk away from this. I remember the last time I went to a job interview, that kind of thing. I was kind of sitting there. I was sort of nervous and really unhappy about it because it was just like my girlfriend told me, Vinny, you know, we're low on money. You know, you need to go out and get a part-time job doing sales or something. And so my friend Jono offered me a job doing insulation sales. And the night before, I got the job. I've got a lot of sales experience and that kind of thing, and I can talk like a salesman can. But the night before, I was lying in bed just worrying about having to go into the workforce tomorrow and just, you know, started to have kind of like hyperventilating and panic attack, basically. And it's my contention that my bad experiences with work have essentially disabled my capacity to do it anymore, like employophobia sort of thing is how I've coined it. And it may not have been my responsibility to go out and become New Zealand's alternative media and that kind of thing, but I did it, and regardless of whether or not it was my responsibility then, because I took responsibility, it is my responsibility now.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, it's funny, the whole like going back into the workforce. I mean, I've had to do it a number of times. I'm kind of on the fence if I have to do it right now. Things are really, really tight here. And it's that same thing. I feel that kind of like real anxiety about doing it. And it's not because I'm opposed to work. That's the funny thing is like I had somebody tell me like, oh, you're too lazy to work. I'm like, do you understand? I work more hours than you do. You know, you think you get up every morning, I go to work. I get up, I go straight from my bed to my computer, start working. And then I'm there for 18 hours. You know, then I like stop to pee. You know, that's it. You know, it's like go back to work. It's like I put in so much more time. So it's not the work that you're afraid of. It's, and this is part of, I think, this new trend is to say, I'm going to work. I'm going to bust my ass. But I'm going to put that effort and time and energy into something that the world needs, that something productive that I feel in my heart is what really needs to be put out there. I don't need, the world doesn't need, I worked for years as a pharmacy technician. You know, I know how bad the pharmaceutical industrial complex is. The world doesn't need more of that. I can't go back to that. You know, something where I'm actually hurting people and I think adding to the problems. I'd rather put all my time and energy into something that I feel is helping people. And that's what it comes down to, I think.
Yeah. So in terms of yourself, what do you need in terms of your immediacy? Okay, you need people to get your books. They're available on Amazon, ladies and gentlemen. You can search on Amazon.com, Alan Abadessa, A-B-B-A-D-E-S-S-A. And he's got three books available on there now. The Sync Book, Myths, Magic, Media, and Mindscapes, 26 authors on synchronicity. Holy cow, 26 authors. That must be a really good book. And I love the title of this next one here. We're All Going to Die Tomorrow, a guidebook for the end of the world and a compendium of the many ways in which we are all totally doomed. Oh, that's so my bag.
This should be right up your alley.
Totally. And of course, the other one is Look at All the Happy Creatures. But on top of actually purchasing the books, it generates a little bit of revenue. But what helps to sell the books even more is if you will purchase a book, read it, and then go back to the listing on Amazon and write a review of the book. Or if you have a website or a radio show, you will actually contact Alan and bring him on or put a banner up for him or something of that nature to support the work that he's doing. Okay, that's real, tangible support that can be seen. And it actually really does work. So there's those sort of things. But what else, Alan? I mean, you've got a lot of projects on the go. I mean, do you take donations or anything?
I do, yeah. I have a website, which is allthehappycreatures.com. There is a donate button there. If someone was feeling particularly generous, that would be very, very welcome. You'd have my eternal gratitude. But as you said, I would really like just things of... Writing reviews on Amazon, I think, really does help for someone who's maybe never heard any of these shows, people who come across these subjects. I think that definitely helps. And yeah, just any kind of input like that, I mean, that's always hugely, hugely welcome. Donations for this period right now would be incredibly welcome. But yeah, it's I think
how much do you need? Like right now, would $500 be kind of like it covers what are your immediate costs?
Well, I don't know. Put me on the spot. I don't know. Okay. Jesus, I guess trying to make it through the next month would trying to get these books out. We are trying to have this Sync Book 2 out for the end of November. Actually trying to push up the date so people can have it for Christmas sales. So this has completely consumed my life right now. If people want to help get at me through the next month, please. Yeah. That would be fantastic. I don't know to put a number on it. I don't know. I guess I find that awkward, but
it does seem awkward. I mean, when I needed to, move house and stuff like that, I knew what my costs were and my move-in sort of thing. So it was about 2,100 New Zealand dollars, that kind of thing. And that was to move in and have all my costs covered, rent a trailer for the move and blah, blah, blah. It was all sussed. And it came in very, very quickly. And so I find it when you give somebody a specific amount, they realize the seriousness of the situation. And I understand in New York, if you're renting a cubicle in an office building, it's like $1,200 a month.
Our lease is actually up in December, in the middle of December, and my wife wants to move. She's like, New York's just too expensive. Now it's hard for me. I've lived here my whole life. This is what I know. And I'm like, okay, I'd be willing to go, but it's that sort of thing of like, you have to have that money to move or to cover the expenses to stay. That's a tough choice. So we're trying to figure that out right now. TheSyncBook.com, and it's S-Y-N-C, TheSyncBook.com. You can find all the books there, radio shows, got tons of archives. And if you wanted to help out, AllTheHappyCreatures.com. There's a donate button there and plus tons of material there. It's all free online. You can check it out. And, any help is greatly appreciated.
All right. Well, I just wanted to wrap up this show by trying to, at least in my capacity, to get you some help you need. I hope you appreciate it, bro.
Very much.
AllTheHappyCreatures.com is the website to go to. Alan, thank you very much, man. It's been an experience in the psychedelic sense of the word. And we'll see you again sometime, assuredly.